Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Today, my guest is Chris Kington Barker, Executive Director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County. Thank you, Chris, for joining me today.
My pleasure.
This is a little different for you.
It, you know, being on this side is kind of fun.
Really?
Yeah.
You just relax.
Letting you do the work.
Exactly. SLO Hospice has a program called Pet Peace of Mind. And when I heard about it, I was so intrigued with the concept. I want you to share the concept with me, and we'll start with that because there's a lot I want to get into.
Okay. The initial concept was to try and keep owners with their animals united through a life-threatening illness and also through end of life. And the premise is that animals have such a significant place in people's lives. When illness occurs, it changes the family dynamic, but what it doesn't change is the relationship between that human and the animal. Trying to keep that relationship together has incredible health benefits for the human who's going through a sickness.
I've never heard of a program like this where the relationship was given so much respect, and the contribution that our pets give to the family or to the individual. And that's why this program of yours really touches me, because I feel and think of my pets as family, as an integral part of every aspect of my life.
Sure.
And so this program, helping people who think like I do, is incredible. It absolutely is. And it just gives so much legitimacy to pets.
It actually started as something that was seen in a lot of hospice programs. And by default, they were trying to attend to the needs of the pets at the same time that they were attending to the human, and not being able to do it very well. Frequently, as need be, the attention is focused on the human. Pets get lost in all of that, and they also sense that something is changing, and animals are so much more aware than we give them, I think, credit for. So the hospice workers and the staff that were providing care for them were finding that these animals really needed attention, and they were trying to do what they could. A program in Oklahoma looked at that and said, you know, we need to address this. So they, with the Banfield Charitable Trust, created some grant funds to try and pilot for some hospices programs to provide services just for the animals to keep them in the homes.
So that's where it started in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
And how long ago was this?
It started about 3 years ago. I started going out online looking for hospice in animals, and I came across a video for this Pet Peace of Mind, and it just touched me.
What are the services that Pet Peace of Mind provides?
If an individual has a life-limiting illness, and for Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, we're a volunteer hospice, so we do not require that the individual be within the last 6 months of their life. We do require that they have a diagnosis or an illness that is going to limit their life. If it is impacting their life so that they need assistance and they can no longer function at the level that they used to function at, then there are services that we can give to them. If they have an animal in the home and they're concerned about being able to continue to have that animal with them, and they want to, but say it's somebody who has Parkinson's and can no longer walk the animal, we can provide services to make sure that that animal is walked so that they don't become so active in the home that they become destructive. If it's that they need assistance with food for that animal, in some circumstances we can assist with that. If it's transporting the animal to the veterinary services, we can assist with that. We also provide services to make sure that for a lot of our clients, they're concerned what's going to happen with their animal when they're no longer here. And we've heard from veterinarians. We've also heard from individuals themselves that they can't imagine that there would ever be a safe and loving home for their animal when they're gone. And in many cases, they would consider euthanizing the animal rather than having them go to another home, just because they just can't imagine they would be well cared for.
I get that.
I understand that too. And so what we've done is create an agreement with those owners, and when they do die, that we will take responsibility and take ownership of those animals. We have protocols and policies in place that we will find a home for those animals. We have foster homes that have been certified by us that we know are good and loving and safe. We'll place the animals in a foster situation until we can find a permanent home. We screen homes for the animals, and we want to make sure that we get them in with a home that's a good fit.
That makes me think of a little cutie pie I saw a picture of in the paper, Marlo.
Marlo, yes.
What's the story with little Marlo?
We have two people who are interested in Marlo right now.
Really?
Yeah, and Marlo is, you know, he's not untypical of the kind of guys that we get. Marlo's mom was on our service. She died while on our service, and her daughter could not keep Marlo, even though she wanted to, because she could only keep one animal, and she already had one that she'd had for a while. So she worked with us to find a good home for Marlo, a permanent home, and he was in that home with a lady who they really got along great for about 8 or 9 months, and unfortunately she had to move into another living situation and could only take one animal, and she too already had an animal. So Marlo got left again. So he's back with...
Poor Marlo.
I know, poor Marlo. So Marlo now has been rehomed twice, and we're looking to rehome him a final time.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. We are talking with Chris Kington Barker, Executive Director of Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, about the Pet Peace of Mind program. One of the things that we are going to start doing is posting these pets on the KCBX Facebook page.
Great.
I wanted to ask you about what are you doing with regards to pet parents or a pet parent that's in the hospital and a pet needs to go visit, or the patient is in need of some fur therapy.
Yeah.
Because that would be me.
Yeah.
So how does that work with the hospital
situation? That's a great question. We do have clients that from time to time have to be readmitted or hospitalized or have a procedure. And there are some things that we assist with to kind of meet compliance for infection control in hospitals. What they would like is to make sure that the animals have had all of their immunizations and they're up to date. We want to make sure they're clean. And then being able to take them in, they prefer that the smaller dogs come in carriers. And the hospitals are getting better about letting the dogs come in and visit because they realize that there's real therapy involved for the owner.
What about the grief that our pets feel when there is illness?
Mm-hmm.
The pet is sidelined, is confused, is lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And so do your volunteers have a protocol for that? How is the pet's grief dealt with?
Yeah. You know, the idea of whether pets grieve or not, they do. If it's during hospice care or end of life care, beds are being moved into unusual places. Their usual layout is shifted and changed, and it all becomes very unsettling. If you add to that, people are stressed. Everybody's routine is turned upside down. Behaviors can change in the animals quite a bit, and we've seen that for some animals, they become more reclusive. Others become needy. In some situations, trying to keep the animal away from the owner, not wanting it to lay on them, afraid it'll hurt them, can be even more unsettling. We have had fosters that have reported that, you know, they've felt like the animals have been grieving, and it really takes gentleness, and it takes care, and it takes being very understanding and patient. Some of it is like grief in humans, that it's grief and you need to get through that, and it's being patient and loving and not have expectations that, you know, that the animals are going to grieve the way we do. So
right. I like the individualistic approach to their needs, because there have been studies and the experts say that dogs especially are sentient, and they have all of the emotions that we have. And we have seen the little guilty look. We have seen the sneaky look. And so you can't help but realize that there's a human in there.
Feels like, doesn't it?
It does.
And we do have other therapy dogs in the program. And in fact, we're getting ready to expand some of our services through another program that we have at Hospice, though, called Positive Encounters. And
Positive Encounters. What's that about?
And that is using therapy animals, again, for some of our other services.
Also, your program, I remember it's not just dogs, that there are people who have other animals, horses and cats. And
the Pet Peace of Mind program is, even though we see mostly dogs, we have placed cats.
That's so, so awesome.
In December, in the first weeks of December, we do a memorial, and it's called Light Up a Life. And Light Up a Life is something that Hospice SLO has been doing for 29 years now. And the purpose of it is, as you're going into the holidays, a lot of times it's really a conflict for people. Here they're going into the holiday season where it's supposed to be joy and families and celebration. And sometimes if you've lost somebody who you love, especially the first year, where everything is a reminder of the absence of that person, it can really be very harsh. So we set up this Light Up a Life memorial to really honor those people that are lost and to give people before the holidays a chance to remember them and celebrate them and celebrate their love. We found that at some of those holiday memorials, we do read names of individuals that submit names of their loved ones for memorials, and we would have animal names submitted.
Oh.
And sometimes, you know, and while it was very sweet, sometimes it would be very disconcerting for people who, you know, would submit the names for their husband who had just passed, or their girlfriend, or mom and dad, and then to have Fluffy, you know, read. It sounds
Fluffy.
Terrible, but,
Fluffy.
You know.
Why is Fluffy being memorialized with my loved one?
Exactly. So what we did was, when we brought in Pet Peace of Mind, we also brought in a Pause to Remember memorial, and we've had it now for 2 years, and it is a service. It's a memorial specifically for pets, and it has really been a beautiful memorial for people to bring pictures of their beloved animals, a way for us to have a memorial that's dedicated to animals and the significance that they bring to our lives.
I know that I would have loved to have taken advantage of something like that when I lost my dog, and to be in a setting where your grief and your loss is validated.
Acknowledged, absolutely.
It would be very comforting to be with other people who are experiencing that same type of loss.
Because, well, you know, that's the other thing too, is that Hospice has been doing, Hospice SLO has been doing pet loss support groups for years. Yeah. So we just started another one on Monday. And I think the hardest thing for them to deal with is the individual that says, just get another dog, you know, and just get another cat. You know, really?
They don't get
it. It's been a month. Get over it. That's probably what we hear the most.
Well, I want to thank you.
My pleasure.
So much for coming in today. And I want to end by quoting the SLO Hospice website that sums up the beautiful intent of this program. Pets offer unconditional love and acceptance, comfort and companionship when it's needed most, such as when a friend or family aren't seen as frequently, or when words are too hard to say. Pets are there for us, and the Pet Peace of Mind program ensures that we are there for them in return. I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas.
And this is Public Radio KCBX. We're asking you to call and support local programs like Issues and Ideas by calling 549-8855 or toll-free 1-800-549-8855. And running things in Pledge Central right now are Hank Hadley, Frank Lanzone, and Catherine Johnson.
Well, thank you, Brian. And yes, Frank, Catherine, and I, and Ty and Anita are all here in Pledge Central waiting to talk to you. We are in the midst of Issues and Ideas, a locally produced talk show that's been around for many years now. And if you're a fan of the show, if you enjoy the work that some of the producers like Larry Rutter and Marisa Waddell and Donna Cheek, Tom Wilmer, Chrissy Hewitt, and Stephen DeLuca take care of, give us a call now at 549-8855. I'd like to thank Tom in Avila Beach and Millard in Santa Barbara, the most recent pledges to KCPX. And you can join them in support of Issues and Ideas right now by calling 549-8855.
We have some great, fabulous thank you gifts available that have been donated by members of the community, which don't cost KCBX any money, but they're thank you gifts that give you an opportunity to take home a thank you gift. And here's one that I haven't mentioned before. It's 40 fish dollars for fish at farmers markets. It's a $90 pledge of support to KCBX, and you'll receive four $10 gift certificates from Slow Fresh Catch that can be redeemed at local farmers markets for fish caught by local fishermen. You can redeem them at the San Luis Obispo Saturday Embassy Suites Farmers Market, Baywood Monday, and Arroyo Grande Wednesday. And they're yours with a pledge of support of $90. KCBX is the place to call, 549-8855. Your dollars are what keep bringing you the programs that you listen to on a regular basis.
We'd also like to offer up for a $120 pledge of support, which is just $10 a month, on acupuncture treatment thanks to Far West Acupuncture on Tufts Street in Napomo. Acupuncture is an ancient and effective method to address a broad range of health issues. It relaxes and invigorates the body and the mind. Far West Acupuncture provides gentle treatments, perfect for the first timer or for those fearful of needles. And it's this will get you a certificate for an initial 2-hour visit for consultation and evaluation, and it could be yours for a $120 pledge of KCBX. And the nice things about this, as Frank mentioned, is that we get to keep the entirety of the pledge, and your local businesses in your community have provided this service.
1-800-549-8855 is the number to call. Online, it's kcbx.org. Let's hear from you this afternoon. We have from Brad's Restaurant in Pismo Beach a $25 gift certificate. It's good for food and beverage, and they're located on Pomeroy in Pismo Beach, and that does not include a tip. It's a $52 pledge of support, and you go home with a $25 gift certificate and the satisfaction of knowing that you've done your fair share to keep KCBX financially healthy.
Something else from, I talked about the hosts of Issues and Ideas. One of them is Tom Wilmer, who is not only a radio producer and a licensed contractor that has done a majority of the work around here at the station, building this the studio that Brian's sitting in right now. He's also an author, and we have a couple copies of his book, The Wine Seeker's Guide to Livermore Valley. It's a $45 pledge of support. It's the latest book by Tom Wilmer. Tells the collective personal story of winemaking in the historic, burgeoning, undersung California wine region of Livermore Valley. So call in with your $45 pledge of support. We'll pass along Tom Wilmer's book to you, The Wine Seeker's Guide to Livermore Valley, for a $45 pledge.
1-800-549-8855 is the number to call. We want to thank Nova one more time. They're located on Higuera Street in San Luis Obispo for providing a scrumptious lunch of delicious sandwiches.
Speaking of lunches, we also have a deal going right now with California Pizza Kitchen in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, going on today, tomorrow, and Friday. They're doing one of their fundraisers where if you bring in a flyer, which we have here at the station, they will present, or they will donate 20% of the check to us. So that's a pretty good way to do it. And we also have a digital copy of this flyer on our website, kcbx.org. You can print out a copy for yourself, or you can just take your mobile device into the California Pizza Kitchen and show that to them, and they'll be able to make that donation with just looking at the scan on your Kindle or your iPad or your iPod or your phone or wherever you can display images. So thanks to California Pizza Kitchen in San Luis Obispo on Paseo Nuevo and on Marsh Street in downtown San Luis Obispo.
Thanks to Gil in Santa Barbara, our newest pledger to Public Radio KCBX. Let's thank you next, or you can be anonymous, but let us hear from you this afternoon at 549-8855. And online at kcbx.org.
Support for KCBX comes from the San Luis Obispo production of Carmen. Five local performing arts groups have come together for two performances to present this tale of love and betrayal, October 12th at 7 o'clock and October 13th at 2. More information is online at pacslo.org. That's pacslo.org. Support also comes from KCBX. Support for KCBX also comes from the San Luis Podiatry Group and Stephen Burke, podorthist, providing comprehensive shoe evaluation, orthotic, and brace fabrication. This is Public Radio KCBX. Call now 549-8855, toll-free 1-800-549-8855. We now rejoin Issues and Ideas.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Cindy Rancic and Bill Wirth from the Santa Maria Valley Historical Society. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cindy, I notice on your business card that you're called a curator, and yet I know you're also the director. Tell me a little bit about those two different roles.
Well, obviously, as the museum director, I'm running a business and presenting a facility for the community to come and learn and appreciate history according to a program that is designed by the society. And so the society is really the people that are involved that create the timeline that will be represented in the museum. And curating has to do with the collections and the exhibits and the things that we have that tell that story.
Bill, what is your role in the society or at the museum?
Well, mostly I escort people through the museum, answer questions, which are many, many questions. And a very interesting part about it is the younger people have no idea about elderly gentlemen, about when I was young and we didn't have all the things that they have now.
Right. I'm sure the pace of change in life is increased. But it also seems to me that, we'll talk a little bit more about this, that the actual knowledge base of our history is also not as rich or as diverse as it should be. What kind of people come to the museum? Are they young or older? Or are they locals or tourists? How does that play out, Cindy?
Well, I was going to say all of the above. We're located right next door to the Chamber of Commerce, so we get a lot of accidental visitors who either are relocating to Santa Maria and decide they want to know more about the town, or they're visiting the town and they want to add something to their visit, like what are we missing or what more could we see, or I've heard this, is it true? And so we become kind of a little fact store, you know, to make their visit increased. We also do school field trips. Third and fourth graders study a lot of California history. And then, of course, we're close to Allen Hancock Community College, so we also get a California State student there who comes in. A lot of them visit with Bill because Bill is walking history.
Thank you, sir. I'd asked him before we went on the air if he had written any of this down yet, and he wasn't too supportive of that idea quite yet, but we sure hope he does. I think there's an African saying that when an older person dies, it's like a tree falls in the forest, and we don't have that anymore. How do people then find out about the museum? Is it just passersby, or do you have a presence on the internet?
That's kind of a mixed bag. Obviously, being located immediately next door to the Chamber of Commerce makes us kind of, you know, we have this great storefront presence. We're currently redoing our website. If you can imagine, the society began back in 1955. We're kind of historical in and of ourselves. It takes a lot for a nonprofit to make the technological advances you want to make, and that requires money and time and effort. And so we're putting all those things together and trying to make ourselves less historical in our presentation to date, but while keeping all of the flavor. So the main way people really learn about us is word of mouth, I think. I think that's still number one.
Interesting. Bill, could you describe some of the artifacts that the museum has, maybe some noteworthy things? I know that a year or so ago, some artifacts about our history that are pretty amazing were discovered in the museum. Tell me about the museum a little bit.
A few months ago, Cindy and I was back in our warehouse, Sometimes I call it the junk room because it's just loaded with material. And Cindy handed me a box, and there were three scrapbooks in this box. Take a look at them and see what they are. And after we wandered through it, we found out that they were letters from Leonard Swett to Abraham Lincoln, and back and forth, and Lincoln to his wife and to his son. Amazing stuff.
Now, who was Mr. Swett, Leonard Swett?
Leonard Swett was Abraham Lincoln's partner in law.
Wow.
They both of them rode horseback around to different cities as lawyers.
Right, in the early days?
In the early days.
So
and both of them decided that after they finished, they wanted Swett wanted Lincoln, of course, to become president. And after he became president, the both of them had ideas of coming to California and do a little gold mining.
Interesting. So did you have to have these letters authenticated by an expert, or was that just a given that they were the real deal?
Well, an expert came from the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., and looked them over.
And verified
that
the real McCoy is
real McCoy.
How do you think the museum acquired this correspondence?
Well, Leonard Swett's daughter lived in Santa Maria, and she worked in a packing shed. And of course, I suppose they were handed down to her children when she died, and she is buried in the Santa Maria Cemetery.
Uh-huh.
And I assumed the children just dumped them off on the museum, not knowing how valuable they were.
Well, having them dumped at the museum is better than other alternatives I can think of, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Cindy, you talk about the artifacts of the museum being about the past, but of course it's a living past. There are people who remember the old days. Bill was saying that he had met or knew Alan Hancock of the Community College fame. But what stands out in the artifacts that you have, and what kind of messages do they have for people of today?
Wow, that's a big question. I guess as far as artifacts go, like you said, history is living, and so part of my job is to curate is not only to take care of the things that we already have, but is to seek out things that we hope to have for the next curator 10, 20, 30 years down the road. There are many, many interesting facets in time, depending on whether you're a millennial or you're Generation X or whether you're a baby boomer. History is relative. And many things have passed through from the eight-track take. We've seen the beginning and end of that. Is that historical? Is it an artifact? Is it just something old? And so we look at all of those aspects. But the most fascinating things, of course, are people's stories and how they get retold and how they get explained. And folks like Bill who can share their oral history about all the different folks that came through are incredibly important. And so everyone learns something when they come in, whether they're 3 years old and they're interested in trains or whether they're 85 years old and they're really looking back and remembering what Bataravia was and that there used to be a sugar beet industry. So it's very encompassing what we're looking at and what we're trying to do.
It seems like, and of course I'm a librarian, we collect things and we organize them and we make them available for people to borrow or use, but there's never any way we could order and have and store and display all the books that are published every year. We have to be selective. I'm sure a museum would be the same. You've only got a certain amount of shelf space or storage space. How do you make those decisions about what to feature or what to discard, etc.?
General rule is discard nothing. I mean, obviously a paperclip can go, but I look at them and say, well, this one's steel. You know, so you can really become very OCD in what you're looking at. And obviously lots of things it's not known whether something's going to become truly important historically or not in this day and time. So there are a few judgment calls that get made. That's why it's great to have a board of directors. So you've got a variety of people from a variety of walks of life making some of the evaluations. My general rule is that we accept everything that's donated and we try to find a perspective on it that places it either at the front, in the back, or maybe a little further out. So it is a challenge. You know, Santa Maria just recently elected its first woman mayor. That to us is a very historical moment. So my first goal was to collect some things from this period that the next curator will love to have when she's trying to show it in 50 years.
So you're not just looking backwards, you're looking forwards every day.
It's like being on a pivot.
or a moving target.
It very much is, and it's great. And like you said, we can't have – one of the hardest things for people who donate things is to understand that everything won't be on display all the time. And the general rule is that anywhere from about 95% is in the back. You only really have 5% of what you want to tell out front. And if you look at the fact that we're, as a nation, we're relatively young in the world, and we're already having problems, you can see what it's like for other nations and for the world as a whole to share its entire history in a textbook or in an artifact or in any object.
I read a story recently about how people, different cultures, view time. And it was sort of making fun of Americans. We tend to view time as the rest of the day or the next summer vacation. But societies like China view time as more like thousands of year increments, millennia. So even how we view time or history can be a cultural artifact. This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Cindy Rancic and Bill Wirth of the Santa Maria Valley Historical Society. Bill is a volunteer at the museum, and Cindy is the executive director and curator. Cindy, it seems, and Bill, either one answer this, please. It seems like our Central Coast is loaded with history, a huge variety of history that goes back thousands of years. What are some of the highlights, do you think, of this region that people should know more about?
Some of the things that people don't understand is way back when we were fighting the Spaniards, and there's stuff in our museum that goes back to those days where Fremont and some of the old Spanish land grants. There's an interesting spot in there where the San Marcos Pass, talking about the Fox and Wood Canyon Road. All that is very important to California.
There was a battle there, wasn't there?
Well, it was a smart range. Fremont was up in San Luis Obispo here, and he moved down to Oceana, around in that area, and he was going to go down and try to take the city of Santa Barbara. But he found out that in the Gaviota Pass, he was going to be booby-trapped. He was, what was the gentleman's name? Cindy?
Foxen?
Yeah, Foxen. His son said, no, I'll show you a secret passage. And they went around Gaviota Pass and took Santa Barbara without firing a shot.
Interesting. You know, I've read that, of course, most of the southwest of the United States, as it is today, was part of originally of Spain and then of Mexico. But in both cases, we're so far from their seat of government, it might be Madrid or Mexico City, that California in many aspects was kind of ungovernable. They did their own thing, the Californios and the Native Americans, because it was just too far from home. And that was one of the reasons, I guess, they resisted central authority, or a lot of Native people here were not that supportive of continuing with the Mexican rule of that time. Now, very interesting. I think in San Luis Obispo, there's a plaque on near City Hall where Fremont and some of his troops camped out. There were Native people here way back in the beginning. Was it mainly the Chumash tribe or other tribes that are around here? Do we know?
Right. The Chumash are generally named as the original homesteaders or owners of this area. They were on the Channel Islands and then came over to the mainland. They were an incredible group because they had the luxury of not having to struggle too much to survive. So they were artists and artisans and storytellers and painters and artists. And so it was easier to live in California than it was many places because our weather is what it is. It's very, very accepting.
I read a story in a book on Native American tribes that some of the first tribes that the Europeans encountered were very fierce, like in the plains, Indians, because these were nomadic tribes. It's kind of like a desert, only instead of sand dunes, it was grass, but there wasn't a lot of game, there wasn't a lot of water, different things. So they were very fierce and very possessive and very warlike. Whereas here in California, the natives were a lot more mellow, if that's a word, because the game was plentiful out of the mountains, the deer or the ocean, the shellfish. Acorns were there to grind into flour, and they just weren't very warlike.
Well, they had a much easier subsistence, and so if you're not scrambling for every, you know, for your very own survival against the elements, I think it means, you know, it's easier to share space and resources when they are plentiful than when it's everything you can do to keep your own group surviving. And really, it was about survival and subsistence as opposed to prosperity. And I think that's one of the wonderful things that this area provides. Is that it is a very welcoming and open location, and it is easier to manage.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. We are in the middle of our fall pledge drive now, and we're asking you to pledge your support for locally produced programs like Issues and Ideas by calling 549-8855 or toll-free 1-800-549-8855. Joining us from Pledge Central is Hank Hadley. Hello, Hank.
Hello, Brian. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
This is a program, Issues and Ideas. It's been around for a long time. It used to be on at 4 o'clock in the afternoons, and as of January, it's been moved to a 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but it's one of our great locally produced talk programs with a number of volunteer hosts, including Larry Rutter and Tom Wilmer and Donna Cheek, and different producers, Ears on Art with Krista Hewitt and Stephen DeLuque, Tom Wilmer, if I didn't mention him, Marisa Waddell does segments at times, and a whole host of local people that put together these programs that you listen to on a Wednesday afternoon. 549-8855. If you appreciate the fact that you're hearing about local events that are going on in your community, let us know that you appreciate that now by calling 549-8855 or toll free 1-800-549-8855 and pledge online at kcbx.org.
Thank you, Hank Hadley.
Frank Lanzone.
$52 pledge of support for this three pairs of scissors sharpened or sewing machine service from Howell's Sewing Machine. And thanks to Paul Howell in Morro Bay for that. They'll sharpen three pairs of scissors, sewing scissors, upholstery scissors, kitchen scissors, household scissors, or you can use this as a credit, a $24 credit toward any sewing machine service. And again, that's a $52 pledge of support. From the general store in Paso, a $25 gift certificate. They offer provisions for picnic, pantry, home with a special focus on local artisans. They're located on the park in downtown Paso. $52 pledge. It's a $25 gift certificate from the general store on 12th Street in Paso. 549-8855 is the number to call.
A couple of items from Kite Hawk Farm. They have donated to us for various pledge amounts. For a $30 pledge of support, we will pass along a bar of Castile soap made with organic Kite Hawk Farm olive oil and other organic ingredients, including lavender and lemongrass. Denise makes small batches of creamy, long-lasting molded soaps, excellent for sensitive skin. Frank. So thanks to Denise at Kite Hawk Farm. For a $30 pledge, we'll pass along some handmade Castile soap from Kite Hawk Farm. Also, they are offering for a $52 pledge of support a 500 milliliter bottle of Kite Hawk Farm 100% certified organic there's a word I can't pronounce, olive oil. It's estate grown and processed and is gold medal winner at the Paso Robles Olive Oil Festival and silver medal winner at the California Mid-State Fair. Smooth, buttery, with slight pepper on the back palate, Frank.
Arbequina.
Nice. Olive oil.
549-8855 is the number to call. We hope you'll call now. I think that makes up for my artisan.
Yeah, artisanal
thing.
But, yes, so Frank enjoys olive oil and he has sensitive skin. So I pick up on both of those.
549-8855 is the number to call. Let's hear from you right now.
Frank is choking, so I will swoop in to save the day and make it flawless so nobody even knows that he was coughing.
And I'm down on the ground and out.
A private wine tasting and tour for 10 guests at Tolosa Winery in San Luis Obispo. Transportation and food are not included. Tours are not available on holiday weekends or after 3 o'clock. And call 2 weeks in advance to schedule. But you and 9 of your friends can take a private tour and tasting at Tolosa Winery on Edna Valley Road in San Luis Obispo, Edna Road. The number is 549-8855, 1-800-549-8855. We have about 19 more minutes of issues and ideas. And then on being one of our, another one of our new additions to the afternoon lineup, let us know what you think of that. And then at 3 o'clock, it's Fresh Air, followed at 4 o'clock by Marketplace, and then at 4:30, the full 2 hours of NPR's news magazine, All Things Considered.
And don't forget, Hank, we still have some of those window shades for automobiles available.
I have not heard that mentioned on this pledge drive, but there they are, right above Anita.
Available for a, can you read over there?
That looks like it would be a $120 pledge of support, and it's actually a two-piece sunshade. They fold up into small circles. I don't know if you've seen that kind of folding technique, and they both have our logo on it, KCBX FM, HD Radio, KCBX.org. So, yeah, it's a two-piece, so it'll fit anything from a Mini Cooper up to a Hummer.
Exactly. And if you, I actually can help you, you can turn them into kites, too.
Oh, nice.
That's, something else I just figured out on the weekend.
Yeah.
549.
So Brian's giving us the wrap-up, nothing to do with how soon we have to get back into the show, just that we've hit the wall.
Just the performance. It's yeah. The performance here. 549-8855. Toll-free 1-800-549-8855. Call now with your pledge of support for issues and ideas. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. This week's guest is mathematician and math evangelist Keith Devlin, who says that schools don't teach most of us what mathematics is, but technology may make us free to discover the wonder of the mathematical thinking as a reflection of the inner world of our minds. That's mathematician and math evangelist Keith Devlin, today's guest on Being, coming up in just about 16 minutes. First, we get back to Brian Reynolds discussing Santa Maria's history, including with folks including Santa Maria Valley Historical Society and Museum. This is Public Radio KCBX. Call now 549-8855.
This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Cindy Rancic and Bill Worth of the Santa Maria Valley Historical Society. Bill is a volunteer at the museum, and Cindy is the executive director and curator. We were talking earlier about the gold rush days in California being really a very diverse time. Miners and fortune seekers from all over the planet, from Europe and from Asia and South America. But it seems like the Central Coast has been very racially diverse all the way through, including a lot of Japanese, a lot of Filipinos, a lot, of course, people from Mexico and places south. Tell us a little bit about, Bill, do you have any memories of the time, the Japanese internment, or any experiences from that time?
Yes, that time, later when they came home, of course, I was working up in Gilroy area and I had a lot of friends who were Japanese, and one of them was Mr. Hirasaki, and I knew his son-in-law and his daughter very well because his son-in-law and I ran a frozen food plant, strawberry frozen food plant for Driscoll up there. And there are so many stories they tell about how some of them were duped into selling their property off, and some of them had real estate agents hold it for them, how they suffered through the internment. And this one young fellow that I work with, Lawson Sakai, he went to campgrounds in Colorado, and they joined the very famous 442. They were the most decorated group over in Europe.
Of soldiers, American soldiers.
Fantastic soldiers.
Yeah, and you could easily understand if they were bitter or not very patriotic because of what their own families were going through, and yet they turned out to be some of the biggest heroes of the entire conflict. I know that here in San Luis Obispo, and probably it's true in Santa Maria, that a lot of the local ranchers, I think the Loomis family was one of them, kept the land in trust for these Japanese Americans, and when they came back, a lot of them were able to restart their operations and vegetable growing and other kinds of agriculture. What are some of the events that you handle, Bill and Cindy, at the museum? I'm sure events are targeted at certain kinds of people, and of course it's also a way to get the word out. What would be some examples of some events you've held recently or are planning?
We're doing a lot. I mean, we do things through exhibits. We have a rotating exhibit that changes pretty much every month, and this month we are featuring the internment, and we're doing a book signing, Diamond in the Desert. It's about a young man playing baseball at the Gila River Internment Center. And we're having an event on Friday based on a Facebook page that got created around history, which is Damn Right I Grew Up in Santa Maria. And it has a pretty huge following, over 1,200 folks. And so we're hosting the gathering, and folks who grew up in Santa Maria are going to be gathering at the museum this coming Friday to meet those Facebook people that they've been exchanging pictures and stories and reminiscing with. In some ways, it's the greatest high school reunion ever without the high school. We are definitely looking at lots of different groups. We want to invite a variety of people to be involved in this, whether it's young folks who are getting their first look at history, whether, you know, and they're really interested in dinosaur bones, or whether they're folks that are looking back and saying, those were the good old days, which these are the good old days, just not yet. And so we're doing a lot of different things with a lot of different groups. And certainly we're not fascinated or fastened to any one group. We want everybody.
Yeah, it would seem like one thing that we've seen in the library context is that there's a lot of people who have stories to tell, but they're not necessarily written down. And there's a lot of people, both actually of any age, but certainly young people and tourists, who want to learn more. And so part of what museums and libraries can do is bring those two audiences together. I think of it as sort of a bucket full of information or a pitcher. Some people have it brimming full with stuff, and others, their pitcher or their bucket's kind of empty. And if there can be some sharing going on there, that's a marvelous thing. What do you think the role of history is or should be in today's world, where everything is kind of dominated by computers, everything's instant? Do you see history getting its due, or do you see some gaps there? Either one of you, do you have an opinion on that? Bill?
Well, I do see some gaps there. Younger generation that I've met at the museum aren't too interested in things until they see it, and then they ask some very interesting questions, like I mentioned Captain Alan Hancock. He had a pilot's license and a sea captain's license, and he did a lot of work in the ocean with his ship that, and down in Galapagos Islands and all places like that. And they asked questions about it, and this lady said to me, "What's that hanging on the wall?" And I said, "It's a sexton." "Huh? What's a sexton?" I said, "Well, I flew in World War II, and it was our only road map when we were out in the ocean, like 500 miles out. The only way to find home is to shoot a star or the moon and get your exact location." And she said to me, "Why don't you use GPS?" Not understanding that back in those days, in history days, we didn't have satellites and such as that.
Yeah, there's a book that I read, and actually a TV show, I want to say it was called Longitude. For thousands of years, using the sextant and star navigation, star-based navigation, you could tell where you were north and south in the latitude, but east and west you didn't have until mariners could develop a reliable seagoing clock. Mm-hmm. So that you had your north and south issues by the stars, unless it was a foggy day or night. At night, but you still had to know where you were on the east-west indicator, and that required a timepiece. So that's kind of fascinating. It seems to me that history is important, maybe the most important of all, because without history, you really can't find your place in today, the present. But on top of that, it's harder to chart a better future. Do you have an opinion about that, Cindy?
Well, I know that genealogy has become an important pastime for many generations. I know that I thought it was kind of unusual when I was a younger person that my grandmother was fascinated with her genealogy, which I didn't understand that that was my genealogy. And we certainly see a lot of folks who come through to do a lot of research at the museum, and they're fascinated by where they came from, how they got here. Their genealogy in many ways is still charting their path, because I came from this, I'm of this, I believe in this, they believed in this. So I think that knowing our genealogy and understanding our own personal history is very important to self-determination.
Let's hold that thought. I'd like to remind everyone that I'm Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're having a fascinating discussion about history and historical museums with Cindy Rancic and Bill Wirth of the Santa Maria Valley Historical Society. We were talking, Cindy, about genealogy and how a lot of times what you get is the bare bones, who married whom and did they have kids and so forth. Did the kids have kids? But there's a lot more to genealogy, like the context or the social times that were going on. Is that what people are particularly interested in?
You know, it really varies. Just as we've discussed various aspects in history, whether we're talking about the Civil War or whether we're reviewing the internment, so people want to know where their family was in these important times. I mean, if you look at my age group and say, where were you when President Kennedy was assassinated? People can launch into stories. Well, now we have, you know, we've come far enough forward that there are people who will say, well, I wasn't born yet. But they want to know where, because it's some aspects of history are so important, they want to know where their family was, what was going on, what were the circumstances, what was the impact, and that informs a little bit about how they feel about themselves and going forward, how they should feel about other aspects of things that are occurring
today.
Their
values or even their life skills. We were talking about some trends, and I want to delve into that a little bit more, but one of the trends, of course, is the world of computers and what I call e-technology, electronic technologies and digitization. I know that there's a huge advantage to historical records that are digitized because you can index them pretty easily, talking about a place or a building or a battle or an event in history. But I know there's a downside, too. I was reading that history, in many cases, has been based on physical documents like letters. We mentioned the Lincoln letters earlier, and diaries. But most people don't write written physical correspondence anymore. It's all on email. How's that going to be addressed?
We have learned, certainly, that nothing really disappears, that most things can be somewhat recoverable, not necessarily...
That's not always a good thing.
Not always a good thing. In fact, that's created a lot of history. So to be reviewed at further dates. So in some ways, nothing ever disappears. But I think that, you know, that is definitely a challenge, and we're at a transition point in how we collect history and how we remind ourselves of it. In some ways, things like e-technology has been the best friend, because people can, like Bill says, they'll come in and they will see a telegraph key and say, what the heck is that? And why didn't you use your cell phone? What do you need it? You know, and so we can create questions and they can be answered relatively quickly. The real question is who's answering it? Is it, you know, Wikipedia? You know, right. And unfortunately, a lot of times we think if we see it in print, it's a truism or it's a fact. And we also know that's not true. Just because it's written down doesn't necessarily make it true. And a lot of things we're still relying on oral histories.
I know a lot of times people will take something as a fact, but not necessarily true. We now have words in our lingo, factoids and truthiness, and that's all. I think Stephen Colbert invented that. Bill, what kind of message would you like young people to have about the importance of history? Very brief.
Well, they don't understand. A lot of the young people just don't understand what history, why it's important. They don't believe we learn from it, and we really should learn a lot from what has gone past.
So they're not only ignorant of it, but in some cases they would have a bias against it.
Right. That's absolutely true.
Well, that's a big task that we would need to go forward with. One final comment from you, Cindy. What would you say to people who might not understand the value of history?
It can be punishing. If you don't, they talk about, when I was a kid, they talk about learning it the hard way. If you don't pay attention to history, it means you're going to have to learn it the hard way.
Yeah, maybe repeat those mistakes. This has been Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today, we have been joined by Cindy Rancic and Bill Wirth of the Santa Maria Valley Historical Society, and we've been talking about the fascinations of history, and in particular here on the Central Coast. Thank you.